Well, it's time to get started. Welcome to our physics talk series. I'd like to remind everybody there is actually no talk next week because it's the Wednesday before Thanksgiving and no students are here anyway and everyone's preparing for Thanksgiving. But the talk after Thanksgiving will be the spokesman of the CERN TOTEM experiment, which is part of the LHC. It's a small angle cross-section experiment and talking about some of the other results of the CERN LHC program. But today, it's a very great pleasure of mine to introduce someone who was introduced to me first by Scientific America magazine and by Devillian Donegan.
Devillian Donegan, a maker of documentaries in D.C. long ago.
They introduced me to John Rubin after I made my book long ago, starting to sound like ancient history. And John and I have been in contact with each other since for many different things. John is actually a scientist from MIT who managed to go off into the world of making science films, science documentaries, has three Emmys and a Peabody Award. And today he's going to be talking about the art of communicating science to the public. So let's all welcome John.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you for having me. So I noticed that some of the flyers advertising the talk mentioned that I would be talking about physics in film. So I'm actually speaking now more generally about presenting science on television, but I will be showing a film this afternoon that has some physics in it if I've left you hungry for more physics in film. And what time is that?
4 o'clock.
So that's a 4 o'clock screening of kind of the aeronautics of raptors. Eagles and such. So that's coming up. So today, I'll first tell you a bit about how I got into television. I was at MIT finishing my graduate degree, and I was working on aspects of human vision. It was a field called computational vision, and just somehow the pleasures of bashing large matrices around, which is how you solve the problems I was interested in, just the luster wore off, and I decided to change directions and go into filmmaking right after finishing my PhD. And I found a very nice fellowship from AAAS, which some of you might like to know about for your students. It's called the Mass Media Fellowship, and it's kind of a great way for a graduate student to dabble in the media, and that's what I did after finishing my degree, and there was no turning back. So that's how I made my turn. So my goals today are just to talk about some of the things I've learned in how to present science on television, and I'll start, and we can make this informal, and you could jump in with questions, or save it for the end. But I'm happy to have you jump in at any point with questions. So I'm just going to share some lessons I've learned in how to present science on television and show you examples from my own work. So here are five heuristics, and already you can get a sense of how messy television is because the heuristics are all non-independent. I tried to find and couldn't make that work. And all of these I'll go into in more detail, and this will structure the talk. So first is, consider your audience, and most importantly, the most important question there is why have they come to watch the thing you've made? And there are very different reasons, and I'll get into that in some detail later. Next, almost always you want to be telling a story rather than providing information, but there are exceptions, and I'll talk about those. You usually want to entertain, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I think one reason the public pays for science is because they love hearing about it and find it exciting and entertaining in and of itself. So there's nothing wrong with entertainment. A high obligation you have on making films is to be clear, not confuse. There are only two big sins in making a film, and that is to be boring or confusing. If you avoid both of those, you're off to a really good start. And then finally, accuracy, which you think would be really easy, and it turns out not to be in film. And I'll give you a few thoughts about why science on television is often plagued with inaccuracies. Okay, so we're going to start now with a couple thoughts about audience. And so here we'll start with an example from Monty Python. And here's an example where a documentary, the makers of the documentary haven't really understood what their audience wants, and this is an illustration of the clash that can ensue. So let's let Monty Python take a crack at it.
Yes,
Gladys. What's the matter? They told me to be stopped.
Tell him more when he got home.
He says, do we want a documentary on mollusks?
Mollusks?
Yes.
What does he mean, mollusks?
Mollusks! Gastropods, the mini rex, cephalopods.
Oh, mollusks. I thought you said bacon. Oh, right. What's he charged then?
It's free.
Oh, where's he want us to sit?
Segmented invertebrate animal, usually protected by a large shell. One of the most numerous groups of invertebrates, it is exceeded in number of species only by the arthropods.
Not very interesting, is it?
Oh,
I was talking to him!
Oh, anyway, the typical mollusk, if it is a snail, consists of a prominent muscular portion, the head foot, a visceral mass and a shell which is secreted by the free edge of the metal.
Dreadful, isn't it?
What?
I was talking to him!
Oh, well, anyway. In some mollusks, however, viz. Slugs, the shell is absent or rudimentary.
Rich-y-roll.
Whereas in others, viz. Cephalopods, the head foot is greatly modified and forms tentacles, viz. The squid.
What are you doing?
Switching you off!
Well, don't you like it?
Oh, it's dreadful!
Embarrassing!
Is it?
Yes, it's perfectly awful!
Christ, I don't know how they got the nerve to put it on.
It's so boring!
Well, it's not much of a subject, is it, Peter?
What do you think, George?
Oh, give him another 20 seconds.
All right.
Anyway, the majority of mollusks are included in three large groups, the gastropods, the invertebrates, and the cephalopods.
We know that!
However, what is more interesting is the mollusk's sex life. Yes, the mollusk is a brandy little fellow who's scarcely strays from the subject of you-know-what.
Disgusting!
Oh, not to be at that.
The brandiest of the gastropods is the lipid. This hot, bloody little beast with its tent-like shell is always on the job. Its extra activities are something starving. Frankly, I don't know how the female lipid finds the time to adhere to the rock face.
Disgusting!
But more interesting.
Oh, yes!
Okay, so there's a mismatch between the audience and the documentary maker, and at the end the documentary maker is trying to, you know, save the day, but it may be too late. But good for us. Anyway, it raises the question: what is your obligation to entertain in making a film? And now that takes us to the question of what your audience has come to the film for. So am I going to tell you about the basic division in two kinds of films, I guess you'd call it. And they differ in one very important fact, and that is how does the information come out? There are basically two ways that can happen. So one way is sometimes information comes out for its own sake, like the Earth is 93 million miles from the Sun, and it could be a list of facts. Well, okay, so that information for its own sake defines the genre of educational film. And when information comes out in the service of a drama or a story, that's a movie or a documentary. And it's really quite a fundamental split in how you go about making these, making nonfiction films. So here is my pointer that doesn't work to the Khan Academy. So that's an example of an educational film, and they're excellent. They're superb. And if you want to learn about how the Krebs cycle works, you'll it's going to be accurate, it's going to be succinct, and you'll get what you came for. They're very, very successful. I think they're fantastic. But that's the other genre. That's information for its own sake. You go to it because you have a particular question about how something works, you get your answer, and you're happy. The other kind of film is one where you're channel surfing, you come across something, or you want to be entertained or told a story, and there the filmmaker has a different obligation. So again, as a filmmaker, you're thinking about why have they come to you, and I'm now going to be in the realm of narrative films because that's what I do. So why have they come to you, and then what level are they at? How do you approach them? And I will tell you that over the last 10 years or so, about 10 years ago, I was at a meeting at National Geographic making a film for them, and a cranky executive producer, actually that's redundant, said, rewrite this at a fourth grade level. So I was taken aback, thought about it. I can come back to what the response was. A few years ago, I was told by another documentary series more advice about the level to pitch at, and I guess discretion should prevent me from telling you that it was Nova, but there, I just told you. They said this. So now, if you extrapolate this trend, we're in a lot of trouble. I actually think that that broadcasters or executives do not have a well-calibrated or well-informed opinion on where the audience is or what they want. I really think that's a disservice. I fight the exhortation to pitch it low. But I will give you some examples of life in the trenches of making narrative film. So here's some examples, and I'll start by examples of a draft script that I wrote, and then the final language as it ended up in the film. This is now Tales Out of School here. So I wrote this. This is a film about paleoanthropology, and this was a story about the discovery of 70-some thousand-year-old jewelry. And my line was this. The significance of discovery. You don't accessorize unless you care about others, what others think about you. Final language. So, kind of blunt to a fault. Another example. I'll read it in case all of you can't see. When painting and carving suddenly appeared. Oh, that's when paintings and carvings suddenly appeared all over Europe, and anyone with a cable and some pigments thought he was an artist. So. That was my writing. Final language. So if you were of a pessimistic frame of mind, you could see a draining of color from the vocabulary on television. I'll give you a couple more language. The same paleoanthropology film. An innovative hunter, this particular early human species, comes up with the walking ape's next killer app, the throwing spear. Final language. Goliath is my nickname for the species. Kind of on the nose. As you can tell, I favor colorful language, and sometimes I walk alone. I'm describing the species as his metabolic rate of 200 watts. Twice of ours, the television executive said, 200 watts? That's light bulb talk. That's true. It's final language. That. So these are trends that I consider kind of lamentable. I don't think. I guess there's no data to go by like what an audience wants to hear. If I were watching, I would want this, but I'm not representative of anything. But here's a good one. Now I would argue that eliminate is a pretty big word. What's that?
Maybe even big.
Yeah, big, yeah. Compendious. and then here's one exhortation from a company. Working in this field, working in the trenches, does have its share of exasperation, moments of exasperation, but None of this is to say that I'm kind of fed up with it. I actually love making films, and it is very difficult, and obviously you butt heads with people who are writing the checks, and despite setbacks like this, I still love making films. So let's talk a little bit more about what level do you approach the audience at. So I guess I just to kind of cap this point about, you know, should you dumb down the language as in the examples we just saw. Well, I think that the level of the language is really independent of the level of the scientific argument. I think you could have complex arguments written simply, and the language is not really the issue. Now, it's not that they're advocating complex scientific arguments either. So my personal hunch, as you can tell, is that kind of dumbing down the language or taking the color out of it makes for duller films. What is better for the audience or which audiences, and what makes for a better way of communicating the scientific content that it's all about, is an empirical issue. I don't know, but you know, my intuition is that helping the audience have fun with it is important. Okay, we're going to move on now to another. It's the second heuristic, which is telling a story. And now I realize, Nick, that I don't have a watch here, so you can help me gauge my time, okay? So telling a story, and here's a clip of the late executive producer of 60 Minutes, Don Hewitt, and he knew a thing or two about narrative documentaries.
The secret of Don Hewitt's success was no secret at all. He'd tell the same thing to his colleagues at work and to his competitors in other networks and to young journalists at conferences.
Yes. What do you think is the most important thing a young journalist like me can learn from an old school journalist?
Fred, what we do on 60 Minutes is what everybody should be doing. And it's four words that every child in the world knows. Tell me a story. And learn how to tell them a story, and you'll be a success.
Don liked to say that 60 Minutes doesn't cover issues. It does stories about people who are swept up in them. It's a technique, he said, as old as time.
Even the people who wrote the Bible were smart enough to know, tell them a story. The issue was evil in the world. The story was Noah. Now, the Bible knew that. And for some reason or other, I latched onto it.
So he knew a thing or two as well as the writers of the Bible, and it applies not just in his world of current events kinds of programming, but I think in science as well. When I am conveying science, I try to do it in the context of a story. That means that there are people you get to know who have an emotional stake in the material, and to my mind, and I think to the minds of a lot of audience, that makes it a lot more interesting. And I'll have examples for you coming up. So we're going back to, I'm just going to step back to the two different kinds of documentary, educational versus narrative. And I was once pitching a film at National Geographic, and somebody in the room, this is very, very early on when they just went there in like 93 or so, I pitched a film that was about animal cognition. And somebody said, you know, with all these different kinds of animals in your proposal, your film seems very educational. And I thought, I was so naive then, I thought that was kind of a high five across the room. And he was trying to put a knife in me, and he was trying to kill the project. He was saying that it was, you know, this is a film of the other genre that they don't do. But again, I was so early on, I didn't even know it was an attempt to snuff the project. The project went through happily. So I'm going to show you now, I'm going to play for you the ways these genres differ. It shows up in everything about the film, in the music, in the script, even in the voice that reads the script. So I'm now going to show you from the project I've been working on right now at National Geographic, the same script read by two different actors. And maybe you can just kind of mentally keep track of which actor is giving you from which actor you feel you're hearing a story, from which actor do you feel you're getting information. That's the difference. And so here's actor number one.
Our journey begins here, in the mountains of North America. A hunter tracks his prey. He's been on the trail for weeks, covering up to 50 miles a day. Unlike pack wolves with pups, this tundra wolf needs to travel hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles to find food. Out here, he's a lone and lonely hunter. And this is what he's looking for. Caribou on the march, heading to summer pastures on the tundra.
Okay, and actor number two.
Our journey begins here, in the mountains of North America. A hunter tracks his prey. He's been on the trail for weeks, covering up to 50 miles a day. Unlike pack wolves with pups, this tundra wolf needs to travel hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles to find food. Out here, he's a lone and lonely hunter. And this is what he's looking for. Caribou on the march, heading to summer pastures on the tundra.
All right, so how many would vote as the better storyteller, actor number one? Actor number two. So a consensus in the room, and I would side with actor number two. I just, when I listen to him, I hear a guy, maybe I picture him by a campfire, he's telling me a story. Actor number one is telling, it just sounds like some facts. It's a little bit hard to dissect it. But the point here is that every element of filmmaking can either support or cut against narrative success, and you don't really have these burdens when you go to the Khan Academy. You don't need actor number two reading you the Krebs cycle. You just want the Krebs cycle, but often you want somebody to tell you a yarn. And I wish this were a joke, but so I'm working on a series right now at National Geographic, and one of the executives viewed a draft of one of the films, and her comment was, "I'm learning too much." And first you kind of hit your head and go, "What?" What it meant was the information was coming out as information. It was not coming out embedded in a story. So it's not as dumb a comment as it may appear. It's a comment you could listen to and do something about. Let's see. I can give you an example. Feature films wrestle with the same issue in every scene. How does information come out in feature films? So I'm going to give you an example here from a very famous film, Chinatown. The information could have come out just in a narrator could have said Evelyn Mulray, the character, was conceived when her father impregnated her sister. So there it is, just the facts. And now, of course, in the movie Chinatown, that's not how it comes. That's not how it comes out. It comes out with the highest of emotional stakes for the character, the characters, and that's what I mean about dramatizing the information or linking the information to characters who have stakes in that information. Now, in documentary, it's hard. You cannot do it at every turn, but it makes for better films when you can do it. So I'm going to play you a clip for Chinatown. It has some measure of violence, so I don't know if I should not do it. It's not. It's. Does anyone?
That's fine.
We can do it. Let's go back. So here is shattering information of high consequence to the characters coming out dramatically. You could have just said it, right? If the Khan Academy would have presented this information differently, but this is kind of a Hollywood approach, and I mean that in a good way, information tied to emotional stakes of the characters. So now I'm going to turn to some examples from my own films. Which, now that I think of it, to follow Chinatown was kind of kind of idiotic, but you only have the films you made. So it's a scene I'll show you. We have it's a film I shot. It's a National Geographic film. I shot it in New Guinea, and it's an expedition in New Guinea to look into the last culture with living memory of human mummification. And so this team of researchers is trying to find a relatively recent mummy to understand more about the process. But every step of the way on this trip, we ran into trouble and our own huge cultural conflict with the locals. So I'll show you how the information came out in the film, and I can tell you more how I did it. But again, I think it's an example of information coming out in the service of a drama, information coming out that has emotional stakes for the people involved. Here we go.
But the expedition is stalled.
And
the team members, the discussion about how to get to Wingia.
So they're trying to get to a place called Wingia. I'm going to back it up.
Someone tested the reporter's telling you today.
I'm going to just back up.
But the expedition is stalled.
And we're going to leave tomorrow morning.
Two local team members joined the discussion about how to get to Wingia.
What do we have for reporters?
You can't hear the porters refuse to go.
So what exactly did the porters tell you today?
There's a dinner for the place I didn't want to go. They cast me in.
The local porters from Aseki remember an old blood feud with Wingia villagers.
They were warriors before. Would they kind of, you know, would it be really dangerous that they would threaten us or anything?
It can be very dangerous. Yeah. 4 or 5 bands will fight. 2,000 bone arrows.
I mean, I take so many risks in my life. I wouldn't be here if I would not take risks. I think it's kind of
a risk for you. It's about risk for the people
I know,
who love you. That's
know.
The important thing. It's not our risk. But we have families. We all have families. We have people we care about. I don't want to get an arrow. I don't at all. But any of it was safe. And he went out. Look, these people, we like these people.
They have tribal fights with or without us.
Tribal fights.
I honestly don't think this is something we can resolve, or this is something we can be too concerned about, because it is...
It is something we can make worse.
Yes.
It is something we can instigate.
With no simple resolution, the team will sleep on it. Uneasily.
So that was actually a real scene in that the members of the expedition got to a point where we were deciding whether to pull the plug on things or actually go ahead to a place where some of the members were genuinely fearful of how it would turn out, and it was a possible risk to the locals and to ourselves. And I just felt this discussion coming up, and I just stepped back and filmed the scene as it unfolded. It wasn't directed. I said, just stop talking now, wait, okay, we'll film it. And I feel that's a decent example of information coming out that is emotionally important to the characters. So you could have done this another way. You could have just seen a scene of these people sitting around the table with not really hearing their dialogue, and just the information could have come out that way, and it would have been nowhere near as effective. So we'll move on to another one of the heuristics for capturing or keeping an audience, and that is entertainment. I think it is a good goal, whether you're talking about mollusks or any topic. And Alfred Hitchcock had the best line on the subject. His definition of what a drama is still sticks. So some tips for drama. So stories, and we've been talking about stories some. telling a story is stories are more entertaining than just information for its own sake. I think surprise is helps an audience. Predictability in a film is a bad thing, and I think humor has great value, although there are plenty of TV executives who will fight me on that point. Now, damn it, I had a good clip here to show you, but I can't make it work, so I'm going to move on to the next stop here. Okay. So here's the film. So this is apropos, I guess, of humor. It's a serious point that the scene is funny and I think engaging. So I'll share it with you. This is a film about what aspects of human cognition separate us from other apes.
Impulse studies have also been run on humans. In a classic experiment from the 1970s, a researcher gave a four-year-old a simple choice.
So if you wait for me to get back, I'll give you this bowl with all of these gummy bears, okay? But if you can't wait, you can push that button like this, and then I'll come back, and you can have this bowl with just this one gummy bear, okay? Okay? Okay, I'll be right back.
You couldn't have cast the kid better, could you?
It's the eyes.
See all those thoughts running through his mind. Can't take it. How music was helping drive the humor. Without music, it would have been, I think, a very different and less funny scene. We'll turn to another example. So this is for a film I made. The topic was invasive species. And again, I wanted to make it entertaining, and here's what we did. Whoop. Okay, you can tell I'm no daily user of PowerPoint.
In the years before World War II, some Pacific islands were plagued by a population explosion of rats, uninvited aliens. Someone had an inspiration. Why not import another species to smite the rats? Monitor lizards. One small problem. The lizards are active during the day when the rats sleep. At night, monitors sleep while rats cause trouble. The two species rarely encounter one another. So the huge reptiles satisfied their hunger with poultry. Clearly the giant lizards needed an alternative diet. So a third alien species was imported for this purpose. Cane toads. As food, they have a shortcoming. They're poisonous. With the death of the monitor lizards, there was an explosion of cane toads, which were eaten by another alien species. Cats. Without cats, the rat population exploded.
So, if you're going to go over the top, I just go all the way.
Where was that at?
Say it again.
Where was that? Where did they bring all these species?
Hawaii.
Hawaii.
Yeah. I actually really looked into it, and that's true. Actually, one of my favorite alien species stories. I do believe this was true, and I didn't dramatize it. There was a parachuting of cats into. They had cats in crates with parachutes that they dropped to deal with some infestation. That didn't work out either. Okay, and here's another alien species story. This is Canada geese, which are running amok, at least in the Northeast, maybe more widespread than that. So this is about the battle against Canada geese.
It's not easy to drive the geese away, though Gerard has certainly tried. He's used inflatable balls with eye patterns designed to frighten geese. But the birds seemed unflappable. Gerard has deployed fake swans on the theory that geese hate swans.
The geese seem to stay away from him for a while, but then realize that they just aren't for real, and they just come right back and start eating again.
Gerard has even taken up arms.
We've tried firecrackers and bottle rockets. Being on the golf course, you can do it a little bit, but after a while, it starts to affect, you know, the golfers.
Perhaps Gerard's boldest effort was a spirited naval campaign.
We purchased a small remote-controlled boat. The geese were in the pond, we put the boat in the water and chased them around with the boat.
But the geese stayed on an even keel. Gerard is losing patience.
And I'll show you another example or two, because it's kind of what I like to do in film. So this is a film about, this is the paleoanthropology film I referred to, and the film is at a point where it's talking about two walking ape species who clearly lived in the same time in the same place, and we're wondering what it might have been like when they encountered each other.
Lucy and Flatface share the same territory for thousands of years. What happens when two smart and curious creatures, similar but separate, come together? Does one try to kill the other? Do they simply compete over food? Do they ignore each other? Or are they downright chummy?
So that's there's not a speck of knowledge about what they did. So it's a way of getting the options out. One more from the alien species show.
But Ogwong suspects his country is suffering because of a different invader.
So we're in Uganda now, and this guy.
One he traces to a romance that took place decades ago. Legend has it that a foreign engineer working in nearby Rwanda in the 1960s falls in love.
So this is some overdone flashback effect.
The man presents his fiancée with an exotic plant, native to South America. Water hyacinth. Presumably, the couple's love grows over the years. Certainly the water hyacinth does.
This was a great ad-lib by the dog.
No one is sure exactly how the foreign plant escapes. But somehow, clumps float downstream. In 1989, water hyacinth was spotted in Lake Victoria. 7 years later, the weed had clogged 80% of Uganda's shoreline. For fishermen and their families, it was a disaster.
Okay, so I'll turn now to one of the other heuristics, and that is to be clear. And let's see, I did decide to get rid of some examples here. Hang on. Okay, so I'll show you now from my film, the film A Genius, which is about human cognition versus cognition of other apes, an experiment with chimpanzees, and I'll show you the early version of how I did it, the rough cut, and then the final version of the film, and you can see how I think the clarity of the presentation improved in a number of ways.
At the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Germany, a chimpanzee is about to receive a pile of treats. At the same time, he's given a rope under the table.
So it's always my voice.
Anytime he gets unhappy,
until the very end,
pull the rope to end the experiment. The rope that's visible is for a second chimp. When she enters, she can pull it to steal the food.
Fine-tuning, but I hope you'll feel it.
In Leipzig, Germany, a chimpanzee is about to receive a tray of monkey chow. At the same time, he's given a rope under the platform. He can pull any time to collapse the platform and end the experiment. Another chimp now enters the cage. This chimp is free to pull a second rope on top of the tray. The first chimp is tipped off. He pulls the hidden rope, and the game's over.
So that was a little clearer what happened there.
Was he just generally outraged, or was he taking specific revenge on the thief? To find out, the researcher now moves the food. Once again, the first chimp has lost his food to the second. All that's changed is who's responsible. In trials where the researcher moves the chow, the first chimp is much less likely to crash the platform. That would punish an innocent chimp who had no intent to do him wrong.
They can gauge who is responsible for something that has been done.
Okay, so that's the kind of fine-tuning, and it just happens again and again and again, and you know, the process works, and what you have to learn to do is trust other people's comments, because after you've been through it six times, you can no longer really hear it. So so every film goes through many, many, many iterations. And let's see, is this... okay. So here I'll turn finally to accuracy. And you think that, like, making films accurate would be the easiest thing of all. How are we doing on time? I turned off my phone, so...
We're doing fine. We're
okay.
A quarter to.
Okay. I was shooting with someone I used to work with in Los Angeles. We went to the Redwoods to shoot. She's like, I'm trying to remember what we were even... up to, but it doesn't matter. And so this is a British guy, and he really liked the idea of showing up on the location without a script, and then he literally, like, brought envelopes so he could write on the back of envelopes, because that was romantic. And so he just scribbles, and the camera starts rolling, and he says, here in the California Redwoods, I'm surrounded by thousands of species. And I say, cut! Like, what? I've never heard that. And he said, yeah, sure. species are here, like right in this. He said about 12. Like it's actually incredibly depauperate, and it's very easy to have wrong information in your head. Now this is an example, this kind of reminder, an interesting example. So I did a film for Nova, and I left the film before final finishing and went on to another project. And in this film, Nova got wrong the correct pairing of base pairs, which is quite a shocking error. So it would be interesting to talk to some of you informally later about your experiences with the accuracy of science on TV. I think it could be improved. So why did these mistakes, how do mistakes happen? Well, so I think a lot of it comes from not knowing what you don't know. And that's the case of the British presenter in the Redwoods. It's a very dangerous thing not to know what you don't know. There's also this pressure for superlatives. And I know when filmmakers sit around in the edit room trying to figure out how the scene is going to go, almost every word that comes out is a superlative as you're making it up. Like, this is the richest coast in the world. And most superlatives will turn out to be wrong, yet there's this kind of self-imposed pressure to make everything the best, the biggest, the most important, and it's rarely going to be true. Another way you can fall victim to errors is to just trust that what people you have filmed have said is accurate, and people on camera make mistakes too, and you have to check their facts as well. So I guess I will just sum up my points and then open it up to questions. So I think when you're presenting science on television, you have to take into account your audience, why they've come. Do they want a story, or do they just want to know how some particular thing works, in which case all you need is clarity. And you have to respect them, and by respect I mean, I guess I'm saying resist the pressures to dumb down the language. So telling a story, if they're not coming purely for information, then tell a story and tell a good one. And there's certainly supposed to be one more, more than one. Now I feel like Rick Perry. Let's see, what is the third? What is the third thing? There we go. Entertain the audience. There's nothing wrong with that as long as you're being accurate. Be clear and suffer over clarity and suffer over accuracy. Is it possible to make good scientific films? I think it is, and I'm not discouraged after many years in doing it. Professionals in Hollywood acknowledge two kinds of successes of films. So one they call audience dependent. So if you have a shark special on Sunday night at 9 o'clock, you're going to do a certain number of rating, and if you promote it and you air it in that time slot, it's going to do well. And then there are those freaky successes that can't be predicted by models and demographics. These are occasions when films succeed because they're good. And that's called execution dependent. So there's actually a phrase for those freakish successes that have to do with the quality of films. So there is room for, doing your best at craft and making a success of it. So I remain optimistic that if you build it and build it well, the audience will come. So that's all I've prepared. So I'm happy to entertain questions.
We have time for questions and discussions.
Actually, I was interested. I wanted to ask what was that application about?
Yes.
I could.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Dull bits cut.
Yeah. Drama is life with the dull bits cut out. Yes.
Yeah.
I read it. I know it. Actually, I have a question.
Sure.
And this is, okay, and I'm trying to identify the source of the quotation. I read it, but I don't remember it, okay?
Okay.
And it's somebody or other who said that to a Nobel Prize winner, to whom he was supposed to explain his research. And he said something like, he said to the Nobel Prize winner, well, you know, I don't know what to assume. And the Nobel Prize winner said something like, you can assume infinite ignorance and unlimited intelligence. And this is what I wish makers of science films would do. Mm-hmm. Assume that I'm smart, but I don't know the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the distinction?
Absolutely. And when you see science on television, what presumptions do you see?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But maybe my demographic is very small, and so maybe that's not why those science films are made for people like me. What's your thought about that?
So I think there are a lot of factors at work. I'll just give you a few. I don't have a totally refined theory, but one is they are, I guess they want to do easy watching, unchallenging watching. So that's they feel that people will leave if you present a challenge or require brains to be active. So if you watch television documentaries, you'll find. The way I put it is, in TV, there's no syllogism unsyllogized. There are no gaps, no effort required. Every dot is connected,
but that's
kind of dull.
Right, exactly. But is that presentation backed up with actual market research, or do they just disrespect us all?
So they do audience testing, but it's not scientific, and mostly it's. I guess what's called biased assimilation. They go in with a prior theory and then they use audience testing to back it up. So I think there's for the amount of money that's at stake, there's very low sophistication in these strongly held beliefs. Like for example, another strongly held belief, and you know, if you ever sit next to a TV executive on an airplane, ask them about birds on television.
I don't fuck
birds.
That.
Don't worry, there are a lot of, most channels don't now, but what they'll tell you is this great truism, birds don't rate. It's nonsense, because I've made like at least two highly rated bird films, but the belief is impervious to data. So,
it used to be that a bird logo could not win the Super Bowl.
Maybe it's part of this conspiracy.
Yeah. A bird logo could not win the Super Bowl.
Was there a breakthrough?
A raven.
Ravens, okay. The curse of the
bird. But I saw something on Nature a few nights ago. It was incredible. It was like about some sort of eagle raptor down in South America carrying on children.
Oh, was it harpy eagles?
Yeah, they have the harpy eagles.
Oh, okay. That's that was unquestionably...
That bird one was actually...
The film I'm going to show at 4 o'clock, is that what you said?
Yeah.
At 4 o'clock, it's called Raptor Force, and great ratings, lots of birds. and it's probably, the guy who made that film is certainly my collaborator on the film.
So what animals do rate?
So dangerous animals rate, so... Crocodiles, sharks. That's right. And so you can ask, and I have a theory. So why? I think television executives believe that fear is a very powerful draw for audiences, and humor isn't, and that's why my language was being kind of toned down or made very bland. And I think maybe there's an objective reason. Like if you get 100 people together and show them a shark. Doing something, 98 out of 100 will agree that it's scary. If you try to do something funny, the best you're going to do is like 60 out of 100. And for a programmer, that's awful. So it could be as simple as that there's more. There's almost total consensus on fear. But that's just that's an untested theory. Yes.
I'm bothered by what I consider to be the necessity of science, which is. Slow, accurate information. Notice where I had slow.
Yes. You find
it's time to absorb scientific information.
Yes.
And in many cases, I've attended science films, which in my opinion were too fast, where
right.
they didn't give the audience time to absorb it and
yep.
reflect on what it means. I don't know if there's an urge to do things fast
yes.
in science.
There's like an arms race of speed from channel to channel, and there's a belief that if your show is slowly paced, people will click and stick to another channel where things are coming faster. And again, I think that's a naive belief. But now, you know, the good news is I'm working on a natural history film right now at National Geographic, and it is really slow. It's slow and riveting, and maybe that will help turn the tide. We'll see, but yeah, they, you know, they see the audience as, well, unsophisticated and jumpy, easy to lose, and so they get desperate.
Okay. Other questions, comments, discussions?
Any thoughts on bad science, such as? On Fox was the moon landing is a hoax.
Oh, okay.
And then you have a whole group of nut cases, I guess. I don't know how to put it.
Yeah, I find those a great social disservice. But look, even friends of mine have worked on a series, I find another kind of disservice. It was a series on National Geographic called Is It Real? And I don't know if that's familiar to any of you, but so it's like a 50-minute show that's a broadcast hour, and each topic is a piece of rubbish, like spontaneous combustion or
cold fusion.
And so these films are 48 minutes wallowing in the false just because it's titillating, followed by a 2-minute debunking, you know, a little 2-minute shower at the end. And I feel that those are actually a great disservice too. But they feel that they've cloaked themselves in respectability, and I'm
what? Is a shower being?
Yes. Well, I mean, look, I didn't work on this.
Thank you.
Series, but then you know, like films with good content can do well. It's not everyone is obligated to join the arms race, and there are counterexamples. So. Yeah.
What's in the water in L.A. that prevents all these movie types and film types from thinking like you?
Well, look, I left L.A. I grew up in L.A., and now I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so, you know, obviously I was a black sheep.
My goodness, no, I agree. I really like the definition of respect for the audience.
Yeah.
And it pains me to see, and it's not just that. I mean, I can relate to military and film and various other things. It's ridiculous. I mean, in many senses.
Yeah.
And there's not too many people who care. I mean, it's either just about ratings or just about the money or whatever, or just purely entertainment. It doesn't matter if it's fact or fiction or souls, whatever.
Yeah. Well, and you know, again, if you just cared about ratings, you wouldn't be making then you might as well, like, really make money.
Yeah.
Right. Which you're not going to do in documentaries. Yeah, no, I mean, it's so about money, so I'll talk a little more out of school. Like, there are TV executives I know that is the ultimate people responsible for writing the check for a show. They will not even ever see any part of the show after minute, like, 38, because there are no commercials after minute 38. They just leave. What happens then is of utter irrelevance. So it's business.
Business is usual.
What? I'd like to remind everybody that the Society of Physics students is having a gathering tonight at 4 o'clock, and we're providing pizza, and John's going to screen one of his shows, Birds of Prey,
Raptor Force. An engineering analysis of raptors. One of the highest-rated bird films.
Highest-rated bird
films.
Besides birds.
But there's lots of bird scene chases with little mini cameras on it.
Yes, we did manage to put cameras on the backs of these birds.
Aviation students should find it great because tonight we're also hosting our 16 prospective physics majors from high school who are applying to be physics majors here next year, and the Society of Physics Students is hosting them with this filming. And our faculty, if they want, also is welcome to come.
It's in 310 Jardine Hall.
Right. Richard has the coordinates. And I think everyone got an email already, but if you don't, 310 Jardine, and I don't even know where that is, but I'm going to follow Richard.
I don't know where he is.
Oh, he is. Okay. So let's thank our speaker again.